As 2016 winds down, we're taking a look back at some of the best news stories we discussed throughout the year. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at BayCareEvents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Carson Cooper. Today on Florida Matters, we're doing a year in review as we remember some of the biggest news stories of 2016 in the Sunshine State. Let's start off by going back to January 28th, the 30th anniversary of the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster. On that day in 1986, millions of people watched in horror when the Challenger exploded off the coast of Cape Canaveral. All seven crew members, including teacher Krista McAuliffe, were killed. Near that anniversary, I sat down with Robert Bishop, the Dean of the College of Engineering at the University of South Florida, and Pat Duggins, who covered the space program for public radio for 25 years and is now the news director at Alabama Public Radio.
When I first arrived at the gates of the Kennedy Space Center, having followed the mushroom cloud out to the launch site, while they were processing my security badges so that I could go in and report on the day's events, I looked over to my left and I saw a school bus from Dade County, Florida, and there was this line of second graders with these hangdog expressions on their faces, and they had seen it. So while NASA was doing their thing with security, I got my recorder and I went over, and the very first interviews that I recorded on my old rickety cassette recorder were these second graders, and just, you know, to get their impressions from that day. Like, one of them said, you know, I thought it was really exciting to have a teacher in space. And when the boosters went off in two directions, you knew there was something wrong. And I kept that cassette for 20 years. And when I wrote my very first book on NASA, Final Countdown, I tracked some of those kids down and their teacher. And it's interesting that they really, until I had called them, it was Christmas time when I finally caught up with them, and they had never really thought about Challenger until that time almost 20 years later. And then all of a sudden the memories started flooding back, and they dug up their little pictures of their little kiddie cameras they had at the time. And it was at that point that it really started to hit them on an emotional level.
Robert Bishop, the shuttle program resumed in September 1988 with the launch of Discovery. With what changes?
Well, I think there was an emotional change in the sense that, you know, people now realized internally and very strongly that exploration could lead to disaster. You know, the interesting thing for many of us is that the space program is where our mathematics and science comes to life. We spend so many years learning about how to apply, you know, the fundamentals, but the space program is where we do that. But at the very foundation, it's about people. At the very foundation, it's about emotions. And so I think at that moment, we realized that our work wasn't necessarily about O-rings. Our work was about, you know, humans.
Pat Duggins, what was the mood at NASA as the launch of Discovery approached? There had to be some added anxiety.
A lot, because there was a lot riding on it. It was almost like Apollo 14, which was the first manned moon mission to go after Apollo 13, which very famously almost cost the lives of the crew. The five members of the Discovery crew were all veterans, and everybody on the crew knew that the whole world was watching them to make sure, okay, is this mission really going to happen? But to a greater extent, the pictures that we see from the Hubble Space Telescope and the International Space Station all stem in part from this first flight after Challenger, because NASA was in the process of sending up tracking and data relay satellites. They only had one up at the time before Challenger. Challenger had the second one, which was lost when the vehicle exploded. And so this network of satellites was crucial so that Hubble could operate, that the Chandra X-ray Observatory could operate, the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory could operate, and the International Space Station could send down all of the clear, real-time pictures that we're so used to. All of that stems from this first post-Challenger mission.
Alabama Public Radio News Director Pat Duggins covered NASA for a quarter century for NPR. Robert Bishop is the dean of the USF College of Engineering. Moving on to the spring, when we said goodbye to a Tampa institution. Tuesday, May 3rd, the Tampa Bay Times purchased its rival across the bay, the Tampa Tribune, and promptly shut the 123-year-old newspaper down. Florida Matters discuss a local newspaper war and the end of the Tribune. Here, Ken Kane, the Tribune's managing editor up until its final edition, says the staff knew its building had been sold, but didn't realize May 3rd would be the end.
We knew there was going to be a major announcement. We also knew that we had to get out of the building pretty soon because they're going to start developing it, and we had to be out by May the 16th. Our owners, up until that time, hadn't signed a lease for us to move, so we knew that things were a little precarious, but we still held out some hope that some other media company like Gannett or Gatehouse or somebody like that was going to buy us and keep us operating.
Most employees came into the building that morning with the intention of putting out the following day's paper.
Oh, absolutely. I conducted a news meeting at 10:15 that morning, and one of the things we sketched out for the front page was news about the Tribune. Mm-hmm. Because we knew there was going to be an announcement, we just didn't know what it was.
And the announcement came when?
Well, at 2:45, there was a manager's meeting where all the department heads, myself included, were called into a small conference room, and in walked Paul Tash, the CEO of Times Publishing, and Neil Brown, the editor of the Times. So at that moment, most of us recognized them, so you could hear audible gasps in the room. The woman next to me started crying before anybody even said anything. Paul tried to small talk for a little bit, like, what's the news today? And we were like, come on, you know, let's get on with it. And he told us right off the bat, you published your last edition this morning and that we're going to close the Tribune and we'll be hiring some people, but for the most of you, we're going to pay you 2 months.
Wayne Garcia, you have worked for both papers and are still close to reporters on both sides of the bay. There's always been healthy competition between Times and Trib reporters, but they also seem to have a lot of respect for each other.
There was a lot of familiarity. There were a lot of people that did have a great deal of respect and also knew that there was a difference between sort of corporate philosophies and the people who led us. And, you know, the reporters and editors who were, you know, really involved in being on the street.
Alexis Milner, the Tribune had been, in a very rough way in recent years. But the Times has also been in dire financial straits for the better part of 10 years. It's gone from more than 400 employees back in 2006 to around half that now, probably fewer. Many of those who remain got pay cuts. Retiree health benefits went away. Times CEO Paul Tash, in a 2004 memo, or was it 2014, told employees, this is a good time to consider your options. He was announcing buyouts here. So the Times no longer has to worry about its competition across the bay, but how long does this keep the wolf from the door?
Well, newspaper revenue, by and large, around the country has been in a steady decline for years now. And so it's a discussion that's going on, you know, all over the place. And back in 2009, when we saw newspapers like the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and the Rocky Mountain News shut down, it made major news everywhere. And this event had less national attention. But the fact is, you look at the challenge that daily newspapers are facing in terms of that revenue flow, it's mighty.
That was Alexis Milner, editor of the Tampa Bay Business Journal. Wayne Garcia, a journalism professor at the University of South Florida and a former reporter at both the Times and Tribune. And Ken Kane, former managing editor of the Tampa Tribune. Florida's legislature has a new House Speaker. Land O'Lakes Republican Richard Corcoran will lead the House for the next 2 years. I spoke with him back in June about his priorities. Here, Corcoran shares his thoughts on some key education policies and gun bills.
The bottom 10% of our academic test scores are now in our classrooms. And during that same time, you have seen a dramatic drop in the performance of our students. The reason for that was because in 1960, it was a different world. Very, very bright women They were teachers or nurses. Now the ceiling's gone. They can be doctors, lawyers, accountants, venture capitalists. And so you've seen, once that ceiling got taken off, we lost a tremendous amount of our best and brightest. The number one country in the world on the international test is Finland. They pay their teachers higher than anyone else, and they have, guess what, the top 20% test scores are in the classroom.
The SAT score is a factor in determining the bonuses. The state's largest teachers union has filed a lawsuit saying it discriminates against older teachers because they have to go so far back to find their SAT scores and they couldn't meet the deadline.
As far as on the best and brightest, they threw everything against the wall. It was discriminatory for age, race, all those things. All of them have been chucked and they'll continue to be chucked out of the courts. Now, as far as the teachers union filing lawsuits, I would like to say to them, you ought to stop. Can I get the teachers union for 1 minute to fight for school children and fight for parents? They don't. All they care about is their union bosses. Another lawsuit that they have filed takes 80,000 low-income kids. 70% of those kids are minorities. Those children were in failing schools, but they were able to get a scholarship and go to another school where they could get an absolute fair chance in life and a real education. And the teachers' union is filing a lawsuit to kick those 80,000 kids out of their schools where they're thriving and doing well and put them back into failing schools.
The tax credit scholarship.
That's correct. Yeah.
Got to wonder, though, an SAT score from 1987, is that a really good way to gauge teaching ability?
Well, first of all, it's not the program does two things. It looks at your effectiveness in a classroom and your aptitude. The aptitude of our teachers in 1960, when we had a much better system, was the highest at any point in the United States of America. So you need both things.
Universal school choice. What about that?
Right now, we are a 100% voucherized system in the state of Florida. Every single person who has a child in the school system, I send my money to Tallahassee. Tallahassee sends that money for my child to go to school, sends it to a local bureaucrat, and that bureaucrat makes the decision on where my child can go to school. Every single person in Florida has a bureaucratic voucher. And I'm sorry, and I don't think this is a novel idea, Carson, but I think that parents probably have a better idea what's best for that child. So do we want a bureaucratic voucher, which is what we have right now, or do you want a parent voucher?
Will the gun bills be back?
What will always be back is our principles. You know, we will govern from our principles. And does the Second Amendment matter? Absolutely it matters. Does the First Amendment matter? Yes, absolutely. So yes, we will govern from our principles and we will protect our Constitution at all costs.
Florida House Speaker Richard Corcoran. This is Florida Matters, and we're doing a year in review of 2016. Coming up.
I think the thing that I'm never going to be able to forget is, you know, speaking with people who were, I spoke to someone who was at the nightclub at the initial shooting.
I'm Carson Cooper. This is Florida Matters. I'm Carson Cooper. This is Florida Matters. Just over 6 months ago was the worst mass shooting in U.S. history. Omar Mateen killed 49 people and wounded 53 others inside the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. Just days after the shooting, Florida Matters focused on the tragedy. That included Florida Matters co-host Robin Sussingham speaking with Abe Abaraya, a reporter at WMFE in Orlando. He spent the early morning hours after the shooting at the hospital where victims were brought, and the following day at a local LGBT community center. Here are his memories.
You know, this is sort of a place where people were gathering. This is a very tight-knit community, the LGBT community in Orlando. So there were a lot of people who were just very fearful. They, at that point in time, they were saying, we don't know, you know, it's not a question of if, but when. You know, they expected to know people who were impacted by this. And so there was a lot of people waiting around for news and, you know, a lot of people hugging. And it was just a very tense scene in Orlando. But there was also a lot of outpouring of support. You know, when I was there, you couldn't go 10, 15 minutes without someone offering a bottle of water, food. And this was being collected at the center. It was being driven to the families who were waiting. So there, and then obviously the lines for blood donations that were, you know, wrapping around buildings, and one blood actually saying, we have enough for today. You know, we're at capacity. Please come back tomorrow and the next day as we, you know, the need will continue.
So many people wanting to do something to contribute in some way. So, Abe, what has stayed with you the most through this reporting?
I think the thing that I'm never going to be able to forget is, you know, speaking with people who were, I spoke to someone who was at the nightclub at the initial shooting. You know, his story was just incredibly powerful of, you know, he brought someone outside, they were with them. And you have to remember at this time when the initial scenes happened, they weren't able to get EMS onto the scene because there were fears of, you know, that there could be a bomb, there could be some other, it wouldn't be safe for EMS. So there were people who were waiting to get transported. Police were coming in with pickup trucks, any kind of vehicle they could, and sort of acting as interim transport.
Abe, can you tell us a little bit about what this person told you that had been in the nightclub and had survived it?
You know, he talked about how that he actually, he was with a woman who'd been shot, and he called her mother and got her on the phone and was talking to her through it. And when she started getting pale, he brought her, you know, tried to actually find someone to take her to the hospital, that, you know, this was someone who couldn't wait. So he, you know, kind of essentially helped to transport, you know, get someone else, another victim, to the hospital quicker.
Florida Matters co-host Robin Sussingham and WMFE reporter Abe Abaraya. This summer, you couldn't turn on the news in Florida without hearing about the Zika virus. The state recently declared there are no longer any Zika transmission zones left, but months ago, officials began advising pregnant women to stay away from parts of Miami where people were testing positive for the virus. Sammy Mack, a reporter with Health News Florida in Miami, spoke in August with some doctors and expectant mothers about their concerns.
Late last fall, Dr. Christine Curry was at a faculty meeting with her colleagues when the conversation turned to new reports linking the Zika virus to a surge in microcephaly in infants in Brazil.
I think it's fair to say that most obstetricians had never heard of this virus a year ago.
Curry is an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Miami Med School and Jackson Memorial. She has a background in virology, and so she volunteered to look into this troubling new virus for the rest of the staff.
I knew from the get-go that it may end up being nothing and just an interesting story out of Brazil, or it may end up being a reproductive game changer, which is, I think, where we're at right now.
For months, screening guidelines have suggested testing pregnant women who have traveled to Zika-affected areas. And until this past week, that meant areas outside the continental U.S. The hazard zone moved much closer, to a one-square-mile zone in Wynwood and Midtown Miami. Health officials announced local mosquitoes probably spread the Zika virus there. Dr. Tom Frieden is head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. On a call with the press, he recommended Zika testing for all pregnant women who have been to that area since June 15th.
What we know about Zika is scary.
Frieden says this is the first time a mosquito bite has been known to lead to a birth defect. By some estimates, up to a third of babies born to women who contracted Zika while pregnant develop microcephaly and other developmental disorders.
But in some ways, what we don't know about Zika is even more unsettling.
There isn't much research on what happens later in childhood. When Curry finds a patient may have been exposed to Zika, she talks to her about getting a test, usually a blood test, that will determine whether she has evidence of the virus in her system. Results have been taking 1 to 3 weeks. While pregnant women tend to be prepared for the anxious waiting periods that come with all sorts of routine testing for birth defects during pregnancy, right now, nothing has quite the profile of Zika.
I have to admit, I got a mosquito bite this morning, and it's probably the first time I ever cried over a mosquito bite.
Zonia Knight is due with her second child in mid-October. Knight lives in Palmetto Bay, but she's spent time in Wynwood, including a dinner the night before pregnant women were told to avoid the area. Knight called her midwife, who's prescribing a screening test.
It would be nice if I could just have my baby already. How can I rush this?
If a test in a pregnant woman does come back positive for having had Zika, then her provider has to add another layer of counseling and monitoring to her prenatal care. Things like ultrasounds, hunting for brain abnormalities, and depending on which trimester she's in, options to terminate the pregnancy. Microcephaly is just one of the symptoms of a baby harmed by Zika. It appears the virus is also associated with deformities of the hands and feet, trouble developing a sucking and later swallowing reflex, and vision and hearing loss. Obstetrician Christine Curry.
I think I picked OBGYN because 95% of the time, I am there for the happiest day of someone's life. Happy birthday. Congratulations. but there's a small fraction of what we do that's really hard.
Curry says she wants women with Zika to be prepared for a tough experience, but she doesn't want them to lose the excitement of having a baby. I'm Sammy Mack in Miami.
. 2016 was a big election year. While lots of attention was paid to the candidates, Florida Matters took a closer look at some of the issues you and your fellow voters thought were important. That includes education and a new wrinkle this year, something called the opt-out movement. Each spring, third graders in the state's public schools must take a standardized reading test. Students who fail can be held back. But some parents don't like those tests and were challenging the state's retention policy in courts. Florida Matters reporter Kathy Carter explains.
The day before school let out, in May, 9-year-old Haley Everett brought home a certificate for making the honor roll at Chokochaty Elementary School in Hernando County. The next day, her grandmother and guardian, Pam Everett, got a call from the school's principal telling her Haley would not be promoted to fourth grade.
My jaw hit the floor. I mean, I couldn't believe it. Here's this student that is two grades above her reading level, and then to tell me they're going to retain it because no score.
Haley had no score on the Florida Standards Assessment because her grandmother told her not to take it. But she did break the seal on the exam and signed her name to it. Everett says that means her granddaughter participated in the test as the state requires. Everett and 13 other plaintiffs from seven counties filed a lawsuit saying their kids were wrongly held back. State law says schools may consider things besides the FSA, like teacher assessments and good report cards, but some districts interpret the law to mean no test score, no promotion. In August, a Leon County judge sided with the plaintiffs, but several school districts appealed, leaving opt-out students in limbo and angering parents like Brandy Paternoster in Broward County.
Let me be clear. I will not go quietly into the night. I stand here for our teachers. I stand here for my children, for all the children. They are more than a test score.
The mother's plea to the Broward County School Board was effective. In late September, Broward dropped its appeal. Paternoster's 9-year-old twins are now fourth graders. Sarasota County Schools also dropped out of the case. So the number of school districts fighting the ruling is down to five. Criticism over mandated testing has grown for years, but proponents say the assessments catch students who fall behind in time to help them. Shan Goff is the Florida Policy Director for the Foundation for Excellence in Education.
Students who are not reading proficiently in third grade are four times more likely not to graduate high school.
Last year, a dozen civil rights groups, including the NAACP and the Urban League, issued a statement criticizing the opt-out movement. They argued testing identifies important inequalities in education for minority and low-income students and for children with disabilities. But the anti-testing chorus is getting louder, and opponents want to make sure lawmakers are listening. The Opt-Out Florida Network issued a voter guide detailing candidates' positions on testing. The group is actively campaigning for politicians sympathetic to their cause. Back in Hernando County at a recent community event, opt-out grandparent Pam Everett gathered signatures on a petition to oust the county's school superintendent.
Our goal is to take it back to the classroom. We want the teachers to teach the class. We want it teacher-generated. You are a taxpayer. Would you like to help us?
On the morning after the judge ruled in her favor, Everett's granddaughter got up early, excited to go back to school. But when they got there, the principal told them Haley would have to go back to third grade. She's now being homeschooled, but Everett says that's not by choice.
This is her school. This is where her friend's at. If I could get her back in, she would go.
But she says she would continue to fight a system that opt-out families say has forced educators to teach to the test.
You know, just because I got her spot back would not mean that I would go away. The system still is broken. It needs to be fixed. This testing needs to go the wayside.
Even if Haley gets promoted, her grandmother says she will always opt out of the FSA. But mandatory retention wouldn't be an issue again until Haley is in 10th grade. As for the lawsuit, plaintiffs in Hernando, Orange, Osceola, Pasco, and Seminole counties are awaiting a ruling on the appeal. I'm Kathy Carter in Tampa.
Well, we all know how the 2016 presidential election turned out. Election news hammered us over the head for months, and not all of it was real. Following Donald Trump's victory over Hillary Clinton, Florida Matters explored how this election was affected by social media, fake news, and fact-checking. I talked to Peter Schorsch, publisher of St. Peter's Blog and Sunburn, Josh Gillen of PolitiFact Florida, and University of South Florida Communications Professor Kelly Burns. Google and Facebook have recently announced measures that they hope will stop the spread of fake news on the internet. They're taking slightly different approaches, but in the end, they hope that updated advertising policies will change things. Kelly, what about fake news? What are we seeing on the internet these days?
Fake news was really the story of this election, in my opinion. We saw so many stories shared on Facebook and Twitter that were intended as clickbait to really drive people to fake websites and generate advertising revenues. And so these stories, especially ones that promoted Trump and his policies and that were anti-Hillary, were very effective.
Peter Schorsch, is it because fake news isn't really curated? I mean, there's no editor on Facebook like there would be for another website like from the New York Times or Tampa Bay Times.
Well, the origin of, I think, 170 of the fake news sites is a city in Macedonia where teenagers there who can't get a job set up these fake news sites and have been making millions of dollars.
Now, Hillary Clinton supporters claim that this fake news mostly denigrated her and favored Donald Trump. Josh Gillen, do you fact check fake news and do you fact check sites like Facebook and Twitter?
Well, it's interesting that this is actually the topic today because I will say that, you know, PolitiFact has covered some of these stories before. One of the more recent ones we had before the election was this fake news story that an electrical worker had come into a polling place in Ohio and had found boxes full of votes for Hillary Clinton that they were allegedly going to slip into the ballot boxes. And there was no source for that or anything. And actually, the photo they were using of this man stacking all these things labeled ballot box was actually from a newspaper in England in 2015. So we are able to go back and find out how these are fake.
Peter Schorsch, the conservative-leaning Media Research Center, conducted a post-election poll, found 69% of voters do not believe the news media are honest and truthful. 78% believe news coverage of the election was biased in favor of Hillary Clinton. What about that?
Well, that's why these fake news sites exist. People don't want information. They want ammunition. And I don't think we're talking enough about why are people clicking on these fake news stories? And it's because of what you're talking about, the perception that there is a bias. The New York Times had to, on Friday, the publisher, put out a letter to his readers saying, we need to do a better job. I'm paraphrasing, but he said, we got this election wrong. We missed what was happening. What I fear now is kind of an overcorrection. I think every story we're going to see out of the media now is, hey, let's go meet the white angry guy that we didn't talk to for the last 2 years. And so now I think we've been biased one way. I'm worried that we're going to go biased the other way in some sort of overcorrection.
And that's it for today's Year in Review. We always like hearing from you. You can send us your 2016 memories by tweeting at Florida Matters or send an email to floridamatters@wusf.org. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. Our show is produced by Stephanie Colombini. I'm Carson Cooper. Thanks for listening.